Thank you, Dr. Azell. The opportunity to be here, it doesn't seem like an act of martyrdom to me. It's been very pleasant. Some of you I've gotten to speak with personally, and that's been a pleasure. And there has been some renewing of old acquaintance. This evening, I would like to just address myself to you in the sense of getting more of a feeling for what would be the process of what I call covenant therapy. As I mentioned earlier this afternoon, it holds that one very important way to do counseling is in the area of marital conflict, one of the most pressing needs probably in terms of the social situation that is imaginable, even as it is expressed in the life of the church. And this approach is rather different from the traditional kinds of therapy, psychotherapy, holding that it is the relationship of two people, that is the patient, is the client, and it is in some way helping to redress the defects of that relationship as presented. It is not very complex diagnostically. You do not have to decide whether or not the relationship is sick. It comes to you wailing and gnashing its teeth and proclaiming itself to be sick. It usually comes in the context of either mutual or unilateral complaint. Person is not revealing to you that he has some serious problem with his own person, personality, but that he is utterly disappointed in a relationship in which he had vested a great deal of hope and his expectation for meaningful life is shattered. One or both of these persons, by the time it is so acute and or chronic, this conflict, that they seek professional help, one or both of them is often so disappointed that he has debated whether to come see you or just cash in. And it is always a complaint about the behavior or lack of specific behavior of the other person. And it is in this context, it is an attempt to come to some agreement with the two principals in a lifestyle that will be mutually satisfying to them. Now, interestingly, most of the complaints are not mutually exclusive. I found that when I started working with couples, very often they do not want two different things of the same nature. But one will want one thing and one will want another, which indicates as though it is not mutually exclusive, the desires that they have. I remember a couple who came to see me. She was clinically depressed, and he was very anxious about her welfare. They reported that their marriage was rocky. He had just returned home after spending 3 or 4 days with his secretary. He had decided to run away with her, having had a fairly long-range affair with her, and after 3 days he became so guilt-ridden in his feelings and so occupied about the welfare of his children, of which there were two, and then tertiarily he was concerned about his wife. And when he went back, they had been up until a brief period of time before they came to see me communicating Roman Catholics, and I suppose this tradition in his life and a devout parental home precipitated the guilt, I suppose, and the reaction to breaking up the marriage. Now, this would be, I suppose, a very critical clinical condition, a depressed girl, and a concerned husband, but one who had no hope for the marriage. but had decided to return to it for the sake of his children and to alleviate his guilt feeling. So he started, this would be typical, to listen to them for a little bit and then ask them what they hoped I could help them to do. What was there? Because very often if somebody has an expectation of you and you don't understand what that expectation is, you may mill around for a while and try to do something else, and they will be hard put to let you do it. So if somebody comes and has a very clear idea of what you should do in terms of the treatment of him or of them, then it's hard to do it another way. So I always like to find out what they hoped I could help them to do. She would like the husband, she'd like an intact marriage, but was very depressed, and she would come out almost every minute or so looking at him and saying, how could you do this to me? And he didn't know. Apparently he thought it was easy, but he didn't want to say so because he did not want to deepen her depression, apparently. So after the preliminaries, and I told him what I thought would be helpful for them, that they might learn to live the hopes that they had had before they were, or when they were in the process of courtship and in early marriage. And so he thought that she thought she was much too sick for that, and he thought that wouldn't work because their problems were deep. And I said, well, this it may be that you are both right, but it happens that, in my judgment, this might be the way to experiment and to see if we could get the home life a little more satisfactory before we started real therapy. So I asked what she thought would be the thing that would be helpful, and I'm not sure what I expected, but I really didn't expect her to say that he would fasten the seat belts on the kids. And here she was, depressed. Her husband has run away, and it was going to stay, but didn't. And so I said, what would be, as far as you know yourself, the thing that would most help your relationship at home? And she said, if he would fasten the seatbelt. While I was a bit unbelieving, I asked her what she meant, fasten the seatbelts on the kids. This was her primary concern, she thought, right at that moment. Well, it's when somebody says they're hurting, and you try to say that they are not, or that in fact they're hurting somewhere else, you'll have a hard task to be very convincing. So I asked her what she meant about it, because if you want somebody to do something, or they tell you they would like something, it's good to find out exactly what it is. And it was that every time that they should go for a ride with the two children, that the husband would support her desire that the seat belts upon the children should be fastened. She had read an article that 90% of those persons who are killed in automobile accidents would have sustained the injury and lived had they had seat belts on. He had read an article which indicated that there are something in the order of 300 or 400 people a year who are trapped in burning automobiles with seat belts fastened, and they would have not been burned to death maybe if they'd had seat belts unfastened. So those two articles were there, were the authority upon which they operated. And so I asked her, as far as you know, that's what you would really like and you think it would be helpful. She said, yes. And I said, what would you give if he were willing to do that? What would you? And then he started to say about this article. And I asked him in a very polite way, just to be quiet. And and that I was not so much, I just wanted to know what she wanted. It's one, that she could have it, or he would even consider it. But I wanted to know precisely what in her mind was a very important thing for her to help the home. And she said that was it, and what she would be willing to give. I forget now just what was the immediate transaction. It was something in the order of that she would not, maybe it was that she would Well, no, she said she didn't know. I think that was the case. Didn't know what she would be, that he'd want for. This was it. Sometimes a person asks them always to state what performance they're willing to give, and if they draw blank, then I find out from the other person what, if in fact, there is any way under which he would consider granting this privilege and what he would desire for performance in reaction to this. And he said that he would be willing to do this if she would not again mention the name of this girl who was his secretary erstwhile. And she said she couldn't do that. She said that there was something in her that she just couldn't do that. And she had kept him awake on three or four nights until early in the morning. One night he said he did not sleep at all. She would just say, "How could you do this? How could you do this? How could you do this? How could you do this to me and to the children and to your parents and to God and to just everybody that she could think of as a significant other?" And she said she could not do that. She was unable not to do that. And I'm convinced that it depends on what you get paid for not doing things, rather than that there's something you really cannot do. And so she agreed that she would make an attempt to not say that if he would fasten the seatbelts on. And he agreed to do that. And she failed one night miserably. This was the first thing that we were able to negotiate. They came back the next week. She failed miserably one night because she kept him awake for 2 or 3 in the morning, going in this repetitive, "Well, how could you do it?" And this sort of thing. So we made another negotiation that he was willing still to keep the seatbelts fastened. And she came back the third time, maybe the third time, and her depression was quite obviously relieved, although she said that she was very depressed. And so in the process of the negotiation, it was that she would not mention this girl's name, and the very next thing was very important to him. She wanted him to talk. And I said, "What do you want him to say? What is it that you'd like him to say?" Well, she just wanted to talk. She wanted a talk time. One of the most frequent negotiations that I make covenanting with a couple is solitude for him and talk time for her. This has to do with couples where the woman's role is primarily that of housewifery, and she is home, and the husband works external to the home as a producer of income. And so with this couple, we negotiated then talk time, which was defined as what they would do at 10:30 on 3 evenings weekly for a half hour when they were ready for bed. That they would just talk, and he was willing to do that. In response for this Monday, Wednesday, and Friday event, on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, he was to have a solitude time, which was defined. And every time anybody wants something, I say, "When do you want it? How do you want it? Where do you want it? Under what circumstances?" I want to know explicitly what it is that this person perceives would be a helpful change in behavior. He wanted solitude, which was defined as Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, I think, from 7 until 8 o'clock. That was because they finished dinner about 6:45, and she would be doing the dishes at that time. And he would either go out in the patio behind their house for that time and have a drink, or else would go about 4 blocks away and drive a bucket of golf balls. And that was it. And she would agree to that, and so on. Now they came back the next week, maybe the fourth time, and she's very angry. Not so much depressed, not very angry. Because the first night, or that they had started the talk time after, he had already had one solitude. And when he started the talk time, he just looked over at her and said, "Start talking." She got angry, started crying, and then started saying, "How could you do this to me?" So they both had said that she had been depressed for 2 days thereafter, but she was okay, pretty much, except quite angry and frustrated when it came. So then we defined the talk time, which I had not carefully done, probably, as that I said, "Now, do you want to talk or want him to talk?" And so it was decided that she would carry the burden of the agenda. He did not have to talk unless he wanted to. She would debrief herself to him, how she was feeling, what had gone on today. She thought that that would be all that she would need. And he was willing, and she, if he would like to debrief to her in any way, she would like it. It would be not more than a half hour and could be shorter at her option. And so it went, and the next time they came, I asked them how many solitudes he had had. He said, "One. Why didn't you have three?" Because things were going... He said, "I really didn't need them." "How many talk times did you have?" "None." "Why not?" "We started talking at the table, and it didn't seem important." So one of the first things you find, and this is why I don't like the long list, is because most of the complaints that a person is able to think, existentially think, not looking to make up, but things that hurt, are those things that hurt in the context of feeling like you have a bad deal and are not fairly dealt with, do not have a good relationship. That if you have a good relationship, you don't think much about them at all. So this was the last time they had this kind of dyad going, because neither felt the need for it, since they enjoyed talking at the table, and he got to play golf on Saturday anyway. So he didn't need to drive the golf ball. And so we define in covenanting, grace is not taking a privilege to which you have a right by covenant. Grace is not taking a privilege to which you have a right by covenant. And these people find that when it's established, that they have the right and perform with reference to it, often they simply don't want the privilege. It was only they wanted it because they felt that their rights were not acknowledged, that they were unfairly dealt with. Most of the dyads that are activated tend not to carry on, not because they were not good and needy at that point, but because they no longer are pertinent. When there is a good relationship going, often you do not need a privilege or want one that you wanted before. Sometimes they change. That they weren't as satisfactory as they thought. Sometimes they seem very unequal in my judgment, almost like a Cadillac for a dollar. This one couple told me that, you know, they were very, very conflicted. They wanted to fight all the time, and I just told them to cool it. I'm very firm. I try to kid them as though I would knock them down very quickly and then pick them up and be ever so gentle with them. It keeps them off balance, sort of. So I just say, hey, you really have to cool it here, because in a sense, if you really want to get your money's worth, you talk to me. Don't fight with one another. I don't need it. You don't need it. They were highly conflicted, and it was something in the order of this guy offered to buy his wife a fur coat, very expensive one, if she would, for a month, give him every day a certain kind of soup. Can you believe it? It was the kind that he had at home often, and she didn't like soup. It was old-fashioned to have this sort of thing. I didn't believe it either, that it was a serious desire. And he willingly and happily bought her this very expensive coat, and that's all she did for it. And I would have thought this was really going to bomb out. It was a turning point in that relationship. So very often they are seemingly trivial things, but when you find sometimes people are highly conflicted in areas that they are embarrassed to tell you what in fact precipitates the fights or arguments in terms of what there is their apparent triviality. With the couple that I began to tell you about, they started, there were about five or six other things, taking out the trash, certain kinds of surveillance over the kids, and certain kinds of relationship of the male parent with the children. And they told me after, I think, 9 sessions, they said that they had no more complaints. If things would carry on as they were then, they felt that they would be satisfied in the marriage. So as typical, then I asked them when they report that to see me in 2 weeks instead of 1. And then if they report things are still going well, no complaints, then 2 more weeks, which makes a minimum of 5 weeks where they say they are mutually contented. And at that time, if we drop actually a covenant in terms of all the provisions on it and signed by me, party A, party B, we the undersigned, in order to attain a more harmonious family life, do hereby enter into the following agreement. They really prize that. And I've contacted them about every 6 months over the next 7 years, and they told me, when they signed the covenant, that they had never had such a good time with each other since they were married 14 years ago. It was the best phase of their marriage, and at least annually since then, they have contact, and they say they have a real good and growing marriage. So they came back once when she was feeling a little depressed, not with reference to the marriage, but in terms of her emotional feelings. And at that time, I did something which I've done on several occasions since then, which has been very interesting to me. I asked them where she was, that is, this girl, and whether or not they did not have a responsibility to her. She was a divorcee with 2 children who felt the need to quit her job. And after the fiasco of the attempted shack up, and then there she quit her job, and this girl swallowed hard, and they decided that the two of them would contact this girl and see if there was some way in which they could help her in terms of what the husband thought he had been very unfair. And while on one or two other occasions where this has been attempted, the other person has just not wanted any conversation at all. In this case, this wife and this other girl became good friends, and they helped her adjust and encourage her to get into a courtship, and this girl thought she never would be able to do this. And so this was on several occasions. I usually just challenge them as to whether or not, as a happy couple, they do not have a responsibility to a third party who has also been offended. Well, this would be, if any couple's problems is typical, then this would be a typical covenanting account. There is no question that it is a very serious, chronic kind of relationship, but there also is no question that when you have a functional agreement that explicitly meets the needs as you project them and the other person responds to them, it takes care of a whole lot of neurotic kinds of anxiety, and much of this is merely stimulated by the conflict. I do not know of any kind of behavior that is appropriate in a marital pattern. Sexual opportunities, frequencies, and always very explicit. And money, well, how much do you want? When do you want it? Do you want any mad money? Is what you don't have to account? Is that what you're talking about? Sharing in the budget? buying a certain thing. And in terms of sexual behavior, you want sexual opportunity? When? Where? How many? What quality? Anything. Tell me what you want. If there's something you want, let me know. And very often, on two or three occasions, the female spouse says, this sounds like prostitution. if your sexual privileges for some performance, really. I said, it does sound just like that, doesn't it? I say, there's an interesting thing, though. So far as I understand, the relationship of marriage and the covenant of marriage, it is the only kind of prostitution that God approved. Well, this is always an unbalancing assertion, particularly. And I found that care and raising of children, just about any kind of a complaint, I take it as face value, and that the conflict as experienced in disappointment of behavior, this is where the action is. Now, it is fairly short-term kind of counseling, always right to the point. One of the real advantages of it is that if it starts off well, in as many as 2 or 3 weeks, there is real hope. And there is nothing like real hopefulness that the marriage will work to start it running again, going again. Sometimes there are false starts. Sometimes persons will not actually perform what they say they would. Always that is defined by me as an inappropriate diet. Anything that doesn't work is no good. And everybody makes mistakes in judgment. All you need is goodwill and somebody who will help you mediate your grievance. It is almost always too difficult for the persons to trust each other. This is why, for instance, I do not encourage them at all to enter into this kind of negotiation alone at home before. If they do, I just take it as that's what they do, but I do not encourage them to do this. As a maintenance kind of relationship, I encourage them once a month to have a covenanting date, which means that monthly they meet where they can talk about their marriage in terms of their disappointments or fulfillment. Disappointments if they have any. My wife and I, we have our covenanting dates in a little place in Idlewild, California, at the Chart House. The reason we do that is because this is a place where you sit close to each other at the table, so it's very difficult to have much conflict there if you have social inhibition. And you don't want some stranger to hear you. And so that really is helpful. And then it's just a matter of getting together. How are things going? Do you have a good deal? Are you contented? Are you satisfied? Am I being fair to you? Some defensiveness easily arises if somebody says, no, you're not being fair to me in this instance. Working it through. Taking the temperature of it, trying to convert it into a romantic date, because if you don't have anything on the agenda, that's also an easy context to have a blast in terms of just assuming that every growing organism and every growing relationship only is momentarily at the peak or optimal performance, and life goes on, there are significant changes. And always, we must grow and adapt. And we're either going to grow better in our relationship and more fully satisfied, or it will tend to stultify or deteriorate. Now, always the question comes when I think of that, I cannot imagine any complaint that any two people could have, or any kind of desire for behavioral change, or any kind of neurotic reaction to the conflict that I have not experienced in the context of counseling. So I'm really convinced that it's the real problem, if there's such a thing as a real problem, and that while what we want and what we value and how we desire may be a product of all sorts of behaviors and experiences and relationships and genetic gifts and congenital adaptation and early childhood experiences and toilet training and thumb sucking and all of these things all contribute together to make us who we are. And that is something so fascinating that I am ever amazed when I do intensive personality study. But it also often is beside the point in terms of resolution of emotional conflict and growing up. So covenanting is based upon a design of the future rather than a description of the past. And whoever we are, when we get to this point, that's who we are. We may have been unfortunate in many of our experiences, but those are the ones we had. We may have been behind the door when the brains were passed out, but those are the ones we've got. We may have had most unhealthy influences at some phase of our life, but that's the life we've had. And so what we are going to do with it now, however deep and mysterious it is, because what are the desires of that heart are the product of that complex personality. And so whether or not those desires can be met as a growth experience for that personality is, I think, to the point, rather than to try to find out why, for instance, a friend of mine likes chocolate ice cream on mincemeat pie for dessert, which, if anybody knows, is a gastronomic horror. He just says it's the greatest. What I would like to discover now is whether or not you get the feel of how I approach marital conflict in terms of process. Obviously, there are a whole lot of nuances and aspects of it that I, in the shortness of time, have overlooked or have not even occurred to me. So I'd like to respond to any questions or comments you have, or queries particularly for explanation, in case it is not clear how to proceed in any or all instances. Sir?
What about testing? Where does testing fit in?
I rarely do testing unless I am using the test for pre and post research data. Okay, and when I do, the tests I use are the MMPI profiles for each, and a Taylor-Johnson crisscross. When I do, then I show them to them and explain to them how I see them and what, if any way, it will be helpful, and maybe talk about a little bit as a kind of an audio-visual. I have, as a rule of thumb, I don't like to have information about people that's significant that they don't have about themselves. Even occasionally I'll give them a copy of a Taylor-Johnson profile, which is not restrictive, although the MMPI is restrictive in terms of the covenant with the New York Psychological Corporation.